Welcome to season two of People Are the Answer. This is our 11th overall episode. I truly believe that people are the only answer to the world's many problems. I'm Jeffrey M. Zucker, a serial entrepreneur, here to learn how innovators are creating outsized, transformational social impact. Today's episode features my friend, Dr. Marion McNabb, CEO of 510 Innovations, a human and data sciences think tank serving the healthcare, cannabis, and ethnogenic plant medicine industries with research, data use, analytics, and publication services. She also co-founded the Massachusetts Cannabis Center of Excellence, a nonprofit that conducts citizen science-focused population studies and programs. Dr. McNabb is also the retail appointee to the Massachusetts Cannabis Advisory Board, and she's the principal investigator of six cannabis research studies. Dr. McNabb also has over 15 years of global public health experience working in the areas of digital health, HIV/AIDS, maternal and child health, and family planning, working primarily in Africa and Haiti. Marion and I had a great discussion about her public health work, cannabis initiatives, and life. Here is Dr. Marion McNabb on People Are the Answer.
Marion, thanks so much for joining me on People Are the Answer.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff, for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
It'd be great if you could just start off by, you know, telling us who you are, you know, where you're based and what your current role is.
Yeah, sure. So my name is Dr. Marion McNabb, and I'm based out of East Boston, and I'm the president of the Cannabis Center of Excellence, which is a 501c3 nonprofit based out of Massachusetts that works on cannabis research, education, and social justice. And I'm also the CEO of a new company called 510 Innovations.
Awesome. Well, we can dig in a little further into each of those as we continue here. But in general, you know, what would you say motivates you?
Interesting. You know, I'm really motivated, I'd say, by a passion for helping and a passion for innovation. Probably first and foremost, you know, my whole career has really centered around trying to address some major public health problems or health problems that our world has faced. And so I've always been, you know, sort of motivated to drive change, to make an impact, and to be successful, both financially and in a career perspective while I do that. But a good part of wanting to give back.
Awesome. And you tell us where you grew up and just kind of what it was like for you growing up.
Yeah, awesome. So I grew up actually in a number of different places. So I was born in Oklahoma and lived there till I was about 12, and then moved to New Orleans, stayed there for a couple of years, and then spent my high school years in Atlanta. And once I graduated, you know, it was interesting being in the South, you know, so I grew up, I now live in Massachusetts, it's a very different place. But, you know, it was interesting. I always, when I was growing up, I always had a love of science and medicine. And I actually always wanted to be a clinical doctor. And when I was in high school, because I was in Atlanta, I was surrounded by the Centers for Disease Control, and my father actually worked for the Centers for Disease Control. So I was exposed to, you know, public health programming at a very young age. And when they asked me in high school, you know, what would you like to do for your career? We had to do a little like 2-week, you know, kind of like, I guess not an internship, but go visit somewhere that you might want to be in your future. And I went to a biosafety lab level 4 at CDC. So I toured where all the infectious diseases were and how they studied them and all that kind of good stuff. It was back way back around Ebola. So my interest in the work that I do now is has definitely been a long time since I was a child. And it's been a an interesting ride since then.
It's cool to hear that you were inspired so early, and then was that experience that you had in high school kind of pivotal for you and where you went after that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I was at that time, you know, the HIV epidemic was emerging. And it was emerging as a real serious, you know, threat. And I, you know, I had started, it makes, you know, I had started so long ago thinking about it. And what it did was, you know, propelled me right after high school. I went to college, but I only went to my first year of college. And then I decided to step back from college, actually, and go do global health work and see if, you know, take some trips and see if I, you know, should work in that area. And I ended up going to Zimbabwe and working on the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And that really, really set the course of how I did my education and all of my career moving forward. It was a very powerful trip for me that I took to Zimbabwe for about 3 months. And then, yeah, from then on, I had a career of about 15 years working to address the HIV epidemic before I started cannabis.
That's absolutely incredible. I mean, I think anyone that can dedicate themselves to public health is amazing. And to do so in a place like Africa and country like Zimbabwe, I'm sure that was transformative for you.
Yeah, it really was. When I was there, I was there for 3 months, at the, so it must have been definitely not even 21. I was at an orphanage and I was teaching and taking care of kids there. And one of the most striking moments of those 3 months was when the nurses and everybody at that home told me, there are some kids that are at this health facility or at this orphanage that have HIV. And there's some that don't. And these kids don't know if they have HIV or not. And I was like, okay, why don't they know? Because in Zimbabwe, we don't have access to the HIV test. So we clinically can presume that these kids have HIV, but we're not actually, you know, able to verify it. And so we just want you to know as a volunteer, when you're bathing them or when you're taking care of them, you know, just be aware to take care of yourself and to understand. And this was a super powerful moment in my life. Like a child couldn't know because they didn't have a test. And right towards the end of my time at that orphanage, there were two children that I had come very close to. Their names were Definite and Doubt. And Definite did not have HIV. And Doubt did. And the way that this woman, the mother of these children, named their children, I think, you know, when they were born, maybe she thought one was definitely going to live and one she doubt would survive. And actually, at the end of my 3 months, those two twin brothers, they were twin brothers, Doubt died. And Doubt did, in fact, have HIV when Definite did not. And that just perplexed me. Why can two children, you know, come from the same mother, one have HIV, one not, you know, it threw me into, I'm gonna study this. So I left there and, you know, went back to school and then moved to St. Louis University and started my sort of career there. It ended up, or my beginning of my undergraduate degree, I started as wanting to go into medicine and become, you know, sort of on the clinical side. And then I ended up at the end with an African-American studies degree. And that's a whole other story in itself. But was very, very helpful and kind of, you know, then continued that was the first part of my three series of educational programming.
Right.
Yeah.
Sounds like absolutely incredible experience. And I mean, the lives that you touched and the things that you must have seen on those trips had to be incredible. And so, you know, you mentioned from there going back to school, and that wasn't your last stop in Africa, though.
No, certainly wasn't. So I went back to St. Louis University. I got my bachelor's degree in African and African American studies. Really, I wanted to understand why the continent and why Africa was the way that it was. Like, I wanted to understand the history. Why was it so poor? Why was there all this racial injustice? And I wanted to understand that so that I could help to design solutions, because I think it's really important to understand our history to know to make change. So after I finished my bachelor's degree, I decided, okay, now I've studied Africa, now I'm going to go back. And I had a couple of choices. I was looking at either going back to Zimbabwe. I was looking at going to Ghana, and I was also looking at going to Ethiopia. And I also, interestingly, had a love of reggae and Rastafarianism at the time, too. And there's a lot of really interesting history around there. And so those are some of the reasons why I had those three countries in my mind at that time. And there was my father, as I mentioned, worked in public health. So he had a colleague in Ethiopia who was working for the Centers for Disease Control. So after I graduated, I took a leap of faith. I bought a ticket and I went over there and I was able to stay with my father's colleague. And that ended up in volunteering for a few months and then ended up in me actually securing a job at Chipaigo, which is an affiliate of Johns Hopkins University. And it was at that time, the US government was starting, and other governments around the world were starting to provide financial resources to address the HIV epidemic. And so I was employed by Chipaigo and Johns Hopkins to kind of help them set up a program in Ethiopia. And so that launched into a 8-year-long career living and working there. I was two stints. I worked 4 years, then I moved to Baltimore for a year, and then I moved back. But it was a really incredibly powerful experience to watch a country go from, really like being onslaughted with a new disease and burden, which was HIV, and really to how do you train healthcare workers? How do you get testing out there? How do you get treatment out there? And it was watching a country learn to adapt to this over 8 years. It was fascinating, fascinating. By the time I left, HIV treatment was operational in, all hospitals of the country and people were trained. So to just watch that from sort of ground zero where people were dying to right. Now we had treatment and what all those interventions went into that was extraordinarily valuable.
Amazing work that you were doing. And what specifically was your role for a lot of those 8 years?
Yeah, so I actually got my master's in public health online while I was living there. And my role was, it started out as basically the number two of the country director. I was like the executive program manager and assistant. And as I got my master's degree, then I was promoted. And at the end of my time, I was the program manager for Johns Hopkins University. So different than the Chipaigo one that I had started on. But I was a program manager for a Hopkins program that oversaw $12 million a year budget and worked with over 125 hospitals around the country. And so my job was to organize trainings, make things happen, so to speak. So we would always, apply for grants, and I was a grant writer, I was a budgeter, I was an activity planner, I helped hire people, I helped run trainings. It was extraordinarily valuable. I think at one point I was running online or sequential trainings for infection prevention in 5 different places at the same time.
Wow.
Yeah, that was pretty wild.
That will certainly help somebody, wearing all those hats helps you both in the nonprofit world as well as, in the startup world where you're often wearing a lot of hats.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's really important. I think that one of the good skills that I learned there was around, budgeting and management and, how do you set up these systems and working with academic institutions. And so, I've definitely been working with the academic sector for a really long time. So it was a great experience to understand that, how do you engage in academics versus, which is a whole different industry, so to speak, than a business industry. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And so, you spent your time in Ethiopia working on reproductive health, it sounds like. And, I also saw some mentions of digital health and UNICEF in your resume. Could you tell me about what you did in those realms?
Yeah, so when I lived in Ethiopia, I was really interested in how do we utilize, because in resource-poor settings, how do you maximize the dollars that you have to be able to work with for the most impact? And so I started to look at trying to understand data trends in the work that we were doing, and trying to really think about how do you maximize the use of digital technologies that were emerging. So when I was in Ethiopia, one of the companies I worked for in the middle of those things was called Therasim. It was an electronic learning management system that we implemented to train doctors about HIV and tuberculosis. So I was doing e-learning 2 decades ago.
Wow.
And as in Ethiopia, without even like broadband internet access, there wasn't cell phone access to data at that point. I had a BlackBerry. It worked in America, but there was no data access in Ethiopia. You could make a phone call. But I was really trying to look at things that were happening in other places and really try and offer really great new advanced opportunities for colleagues in Ethiopia. So that really kind of, that work when I started that, you know, really took off when I moved to Boston. So when I left Ethiopia, to pursue a doctoral degree at Boston University. And so in 2010, I landed in Boston to start my doctoral program and got a job also with Pathfinder International. And so I continued on my global health work, but from the state side. And Pathfinder International is based out of Watertown, and they work on sexual reproductive health and rights programming around the world as well. And they hired me. I got the job there as a specific role. The organization was interested in expanding in digital health. So they wanted to learn about how do they use text messaging, or how do we do online surveys, or how do we implement technology into development programs, and how do you do that effectively? And the organization wanted to do it to build up a new core area of its work. So I ended up getting the job, and they gave me a $250,000 budget and said, okay, here's a budget. We have a demonstration project that we'd like to start in these 2 years, and here's a 2-year budget. And we'd like you to grow this budget and grow our programming with this pilot money. She said, great, that's a great idea. So the project was to implement a maternal and child health mobile application in Nigeria, and to see if this mobile health application would improve the clinical outcomes of pregnant women and their babies. And the mobile application was to be used by healthcare workers. And the reason why it was important at the time is, you know, healthcare workers in that time, in these settings, often had paper ledgers, and there's not electronic medical records, and it's difficult to really drill down into that data and make sure that you're making the right clinical decisions and you're collecting that information. So we implemented this app. It worked. It was really, you know, great. The colleague that I worked with now is now an international expert in this, which is really exciting. So we kind of all started together, and he's one of the global leaders now. And as that one project with Nigeria was implemented, I was able to expand Pathfinder's programming in digital health to over $3.5 million and almost 12 projects in 7 countries. So they found that to be extraordinarily successful. And so did I. I thought, you know, at that time, digital health was really an emerging area, and in global health. So,
and it still is, honestly. You know, there's still so much work to do when it comes to maximizing data and just the digital side of healthcare. You know, I think we are starting to get to the point where we are collecting more and more data, and then there's certain people and companies out there that are trying to figure out how do we put all this together to actually create useful knowledge from this.
Yeah. And I think the United States has a lot to learn, to be honest. I mean, what happened was in the health boom where we are, and in our healthcare system, all of our electronic medical records are very fragmented, and you don't have a lot of data sharing. I mean, I can show up to the doctor, my primary care doc and my cardiologist won't be able to see the same health record. And that's a problem. And for our healthcare system. So I do think we still have so much more room to learn and be able to work on interoperability and data layers that really allow us to use information more effectively and better to have precision healthcare. So what happened was I was working on that project with Pathfinder, and then I was bopping around the world. All right, I was telling you I had 13 projects in 7 countries. I was 60% of my life was on a plane. I didn't necessarily know what day it was or what time zone I was in. I was effectively doing projects, but I was on calls with America at night and India in the morning. And around that time, it was all very successful, is actually when it became legal for cannabis in Massachusetts. And I thought, well, wow, this is quite interesting. Really wanted to started to think about transitioning my career. But my last project, in global digital health, before I did launch into the cannabis industry, was working for UNICEF, and it was a really great honor. UNICEF, all the UN organizations, World Health Organization, all these other groups, really worked to create those standards and, approaches for development and guiding things forward. So USAID and WHO had come up with their own frameworks and tools, and UNICEF was quite interested in understanding how they could apply digital technologies in their next 20-year strategy. And so I bid on a contract and was accepted, and I helped facilitate a process for UNICEF in New York and all of the UNICEF countries around the world to develop what is now the digital approach to health at UNICEF. So it's something I'm very proud of. It was not an easy contract to accomplish when you're trying to gain consensus with countries all around the world that have different priorities and in a UN system, but was able
not
to
do mention, it. Not to mention the various cultures you're dealing with. I mean, negotiating in general is difficult, but with all of these different cultures, with all these different goals, you should be very proud, because it's quite the accomplishment to be able to get those to come together.
Yeah, thank you. And especially when in an organization, in a hierarchy like UNICEF, when we were looking at, strategic regions, and we're talking about technology advancements. Now, technology advancements are all different in all these different regions. So if you look at the Asian region, or if you look at the African, or if you look at the European, they all have their own priorities or their own level of advancement in technology and adopting of these solutions. So yeah, it was quite interesting to work with them. And how I approached it was, I don't have the answers. I want to create a framework where you all know, you're the expertise. So let's create a framework in a way to highlight what you think is the priority. And so we went through a number of interviews and a number of stakeholder meetings where we had representatives from each of the regions comment and contribute. So it was more around the process of designing and engaging that I brought to the table and tried to highlight their expertise, if that makes sense. I didn't go in and say, hey, UNICEF, you need to implement blah, blah, blah technologies. I was technology agnostic. I was just as a way to facilitate the communication and to get the job done. So
That's such an important role, and one that I think your pardon is going to continue to reverberate probably throughout history.
Oh, thanks.
Absolutely. I mean, that's such important work, and as is what you're doing now in the cannabis industry. I'm curious, how did you go from UNICEF and the other areas that you were in and transition into cannabis?
Yeah, so I was living in Massachusetts. It became legal for adult use. And it was in the middle of my UNICEF consultancy, actually. I met a friend, Brady McCaffrey, and he was interested in looking into the cannabis industry too, and kind of now that it was legal. And so we decided to form a company together, and we started Cannabis Community Care and Research Network. And that year, you all hosted the competition at Boston University. And so as an alum, I was very excited to see that BU and Greenland Partners was hosting an ancillary cannabis startup competition. I was like, great, I'm an ancillary business. This is an idea. And what I wanted to do was to think about, you know, the areas that, I mean, obviously I'm in public health and I'm a researcher, but also very staunch social justice advocate. And so we formed together and I competed in the competition and won the competition today to basically start the Cannabis Center of Excellence, which I now run. So it was a very successful competition in my in my eyes. But I wanted to, and what we had always started and have been since the last 5 years advocating around is for more access to cannabis research, education, and social justice. And because, you know, cannabis has been federally illegal, it's hampered all of the local United States abilities to conduct cannabis research studies. And I, you know, live in Massachusetts, which has, you know, well over 100 institutions of higher education. It's really a healthcare tourism place, I would say, you know, really have some of the highest healthcare in the world. So why couldn't Massachusetts be a leader in cannabis research and education moving forward? So we started, we won the competition. And in the first couple of years, as everything was being set up here with the Cannabis Advisory Board and the Cannabis Control Commission, we submitted and testified countless numbers of times, submitted hundreds and hundreds of pages of academic testimony, which I'm excited some of them are now being revived and used again. And really to call for cannabis research, the cannabis research license that exists here, open data that the Massachusetts Cannabis Control Commission had and does now have, open data platform. And social justice. So we, you know, participated in, you know, sort of the last couple of years of the social justice program. And really, I wanted to think about how do some of those global public health data principles and principles, how can they be applied here? And I still believe that a lot of my experience in HIV really is helpful in the cannabis industry. You know, we had to deal with stigma. We had to deal with, you know, disclosures. And so there's just, I thought, you know, perhaps maybe I could apply some of those lessons here. And
I think that was really profound. Honestly, I think, you know, the average citizen that isn't engaged directly with the cannabis industry may not realize, one, how important this research and data is, two, how there's such a lack of it, and three, how difficult the federal government makes it to obtain that data and do that research. And really, this cannabis plant, we've already seen so many things that it can do, but it needs tremendous amounts of research for us to really tap into all of its potential, for us to understand how it interacts with different body chemistries and so on. And I think, you know, when Mike and I first saw your application, we were really excited to see that there was someone trying to bridge some of this data divide within cannabis that is still so needed.
Yeah. And, you know, thank you for the support. I'm so glad that you hosted that competition and believed in the idea. I, you know, there are other countries are leading in clinical research, and there's you know, studies that are out there documenting a lot of this stuff. And I think where we're at now is trying to understand personalized medicine and human populations in the U.S., you know. So we see every day that there's, you know, more information coming out. Israel's a huge leader. Canada's a huge leader in this area. You know, obviously they have just different sort of national systems and priorities around funding and research around medical cannabis. But it's extraordinarily difficult in the United States, and still is. You as a cannabis researcher, you know, in an academic institution, you really have a very limited government supply that you can use to study. It's a very onerous process to get the funding to do it. It's like as you well know, our colleague, Dr. Sue Sisley, it took her over a decade just to get one study up and running. And that's really just not acceptable, primarily because cannabis was in our U.S. pharmacopoeia. It was prescribed by doctors and then, you know, removed off of and put on Schedule One and federal illegality, which just removed information about it in our healthcare provider education systems. Really not a lot of grant funding out there. I would say that's been a real struggle. Recently, an article, I'd say it was a couple of months ago, came out that really documented where the last 20 to 30 years worth of financial funding for cannabis research has gone to. And it did show that I believe over 90% of that funding was intended to show harms. And so when we talk about research, it's important to understand, you know, who's funding it? What are the objectives of that research?
Really bias is a very important aspect of it. We're looking for unbiased research. And like you said, so much, especially of the earlier research that does exist, was, you know, you're only going to get this money if you can show that it's doing bad things. Mm-hmm. And it was, it's incredibly frustrating to see. And now we're starting to see, you know, things trickle out here and there that are more objective. And hopefully that can continue.
Yeah. I think it's just a really exciting opportunity we have now here in Massachusetts and in other states that are really adopting the research license category or providing, you know, funding resources towards that. Some states are using tax money to provide funding opportunities for researchers to be able to conduct studies. So I think it's just a really exciting time. And especially here in the industry in Massachusetts, we're in our fifth year. And, you know, there's a lot of revenue coming in and, you know, where can we take this to the next level here? And not only in Massachusetts, but nationwide. So.
Well, I will say, as you've surely heard me say before, you were the best winner we possibly could have imagined for that first year. And So the listeners are aware, you know, Mike and I help the teams that are in the finals. We don't judge them. The judges picked you guys as the winner and they were right. And you set an example for all the winners that since you, we did our fifth annual this year, which was so exciting. And now it's just been amazing to watch over these 5 years. You've become a true force in the Massachusetts cannabis industry and joined the Cannabis Advisory Board. So it's been really incredible to watch.
Thanks. Yeah, it's been an incredible journey. I'm really, really excited about the nomination to the Massachusetts Cannabis Advisory Board. So I was nominated by the treasurer in October, and I'll serve a 2-year term. And what the advisory board does is provide recommendations on certain areas to the commission, to the Cannabis Control Commission here. So my particular area of expertise that I've been assigned for is retail. And so that's quite exciting. I think it's appropriate. I've been talking a lot about, other research studies, but I guess forgot to mention that we did conduct several research studies over the last few years. I actually have run 6 different cannabis research studies now since the start of my work and the work of all of the team. And this started about 4 years ago when a professor at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, reached out and said, you know what, I have tenure, I can't get fired, but I really want to work in the cannabis industry, but I need to have a partner that's an academic partner that would work with me on these things. I said, sure, absolutely. And so we partnered together with UMass Dartmouth and C3RN at the time, and now the Center of Excellence. And we have an agreement with their Institutional Review Board, which is a human subjects ethical review board, that we can conduct studies. And we can conduct basically epidemiological studies under our existing arrangement that we don't collect any personal identifying information from anybody. So we don't fall under HIPAA. And we have successfully run now 6 studies. The first one, and this is why the first one was understanding cannabis consumers and patients in Massachusetts and nationally. Why do people consume cannabis? How much are they consuming? For what types of health conditions or other kinds of associated relief? How much do they spend? How much they consume? What do they prefer? How do they get their knowledge? Do they talk to their healthcare providers about it? Etc. And that started in 2018. And we then moved into a veterans study in 2019. And then COVID hit. And I ran a COVID study and how did COVID impact adult use consumers and patients. And so understanding and hearing from people who access cannabis retail, outlets has been something I've been doing for 6 years. And so I think the treasurer's office is quite excited to hear that and to come from a nonprofit perspective and a researcher perspective, you know, and kind of trying to drive the Commonwealth forward with data and excellence was, you know, favorable to Rob or with the treasurer's office. So I'm really excited that I did get the appointment. I've had the first cannabis advisory board meeting, attended that and excited for the next 2 years, what's to come. But one of the key points that I've learned, and this is, I guess, the tune that I've been singing for quite a while now, but more specifically in the last couple of months, is that from all of these 5 years of study and data and results, what I have found is that between 50 and 76% of the people that consume or cannabis for medical or adult use purposes and report in our research studies are doing so to reduce unwanted over-the-counter prescription or opioid use. And from a public health perspective, cannabis is a non-lethal substance and really has could be, you know, potentially considered as a good harm reduction approach. And so really just trying to understand and now grapple with this data and the things that we've been seeing and kind of really reach back out and to the public health and the health community to kind of let them know, hey, this is, you know, kind of what's happening. And so, yeah, I've been spending the last couple of months at every one of these expos doing a 5-year data and review presentation, and I'll do a couple more next week. And I think it's, you know, just a really important point for the industry, the cannabis industry to know about, but also the healthcare provider and public health communities. As we've seen COVID, you know, the devastating impacts of COVID in the last couple of years have actually exacerbated this. And we're seeing now trends in our research studies of people reporting cannabis use more so for anxiety and less so for chronic pain. Now that's a change in data trends that we've seen. So, you know, really trying to understand these nuances of how people are consuming this plant, for what health conditions, and in what, you know, other health interventions has been quite interesting.
Yeah, it's really important work as we get an understanding of what people use the plant for and why. I think there's a lot of people out there, they hear recreational, you know, as you and I call, and a lot of people in the industry call adult use, because so many people are using it for other reasons. They're not using it necessarily for recreation, like you said, whether it's sleep, anxiety, you know, hunger, or to lessen their opioid consumption. And I think the fact that people feel that it is a good substitute for many over-the-counter prescription medicine, as well as, you know, or over-the-counter medicine as well as prescription medicine, I'm sure there's obviously dollars on that side of the fence, and I'm sure those keep up some of the hurdles that we have, but despite that, people like you are pushing through and getting some of this research out there. And I think that it's crucial for us to move forward. And like you said, it's truly a public health issue. And in my efforts to get medical cannabis legalized in my home state of South Carolina, our original home state, and in other places as well as federally, I've certainly been trying to make it clear and evident that cannabis can really reduce opioid consumption. It's been shown to reduce opioid deaths in places where it's legal. So there's been so much media about the opioid crisis, and cannabis truly is a tool. It's not the answer necessarily, but it's a tool that can help lessen the devastation from it. And I think research like yours is really important in helping to make that point.
Yeah, thank you. I agree. And I think one of the approaches, the interesting approaches that we've taken over the last 5 years and in conducting these studies is trying to rapidly get the word out there and utilize a lot of the work in educational programs. So not only conducting the studies, but actually then putting that data into practice as quickly as possible. And either that be through community education programs or through policy, like we have a bill in the Massachusetts State House right now based on veterans data, for example. But over the last 5 years, I've we I can't even believe it. We organized over 30 high-level educational events surrounding these the data points and the research studies that I talked about. So we had a six-part event series right after we won the competition with you. And we had, in 2019, we ran six events with the Veterans Health and Medical Cannabis Study. Part of, you know, the way that we have conducted these studies is partnerships with the industry. They provide financial support, and also we've helped us get the word out about the studies. And we, one of the interventions that we've done is going back to a dispensary and said, a medical dispensary, patients, we'd ask you to fill out a survey. Now come back and present that data back to the patients that filled it out. And wow, I've done a couple of these events, and just incredibly transformative from a public health intervention level. I'll give you an example. 2 weeks ago, I was at a pop-up. I'm running a, because of all the results and the things that we've talked about from consumers and patients, actually earlier, where are we now? I'm like, is it this year, last year, earlier this year? You know, I said second year in the COVID pandemic.
Time is very confusing in a COVID world.
It is. Okay, thank you for that. So we launched a healthcare provider knowledge, attitude, and practices study, because now we understand, okay, we really want to know what our healthcare providers know. So I was at a pop-up event with one of my partners, who's a study partner, a couple weeks ago. And it was just a couple, you know, having a little table there. So when patients and customers are walking in and out, they can, you know, stop by and I talk to them about the research. And I've also launched an art project as well around cannabis and opioid awareness, which I could talk a little more about. But I had my art there. And to your point of adult use, personal use, recreational, this was an adult use facility, but a woman walked up to me and she goes, she saw my art and she goes, oh my God, are you Dr. Mary McNabb? And I was like, yes. Hi, what's up? Yep, this is the art and this is what I do, Cannabis Center of Excellence. And she was like, I cannot thank you enough. She was like, look, I am a school teacher. And I have learned from all of your work around the medical cannabis and the role, and your research and your findings have helped me so much understand my anxiety and my cannabis consumption and how I can deal with this myself. And we're in an adult use facility. She's talking about a medical problem, right? And there's a lot of people that don't want to get a medical card, but there's a lot of advantages to get a medical card. But some people may be fired, and that, you know, there's still some issues that we have to deal with. But just the fact that this woman was like, wow, I've in my own personal use been able to now change because this work was just like so striking to me, you know? And then I was like, oh man, can I take a picture with you? And she goes, no, that's the problem. I can't talk about my use because I'll get fired from my job. And I was like, right. And she was like, keep doing what you're doing. And I'm like, okay, but this is an important issue, you know? And like, she can't come out across it. And there's, so we still have, you know, with our healthcare providers not knowing much about it or not being able to prescribe and recommend, and the story that I just told you, or, you know, the data that we see that patients and consumers are having to navigate these things on their own without having the good guidance of their healthcare providers, and that's a problem.
Absolutely. There's still such a tremendous amount of work to do to get the cannabis industry where it needs to maximize its public benefit. And like you said, the fact that she can't have these regular conversations with her usual doctor is one aspect that highlights that. And there's still so much to do on the legal side and the criminal justice side. And as we can see here on the healthcare side, but it's people like you that are pushing us in that right direction.
Thanks. Yeah. Trying. It's important work. I think it still needs to be done.
Absolutely. And, you know, we've been talking about your awesome research and work in cannabis. But for the people out there that aren't too familiar with it, could you just give kind of a brief explanation of what exactly is the Cannabis Center of Excellence?
Yes. So the Cannabis Center of Excellence, it's a 501c3 nonprofit. And what we are is a virtual resource for academics, policymakers, consumers, patients, and the cannabis industry to drive innovation forward. And what we do is we conduct research studies and we do educational programs and we do work in social justice. And our work in social justice is focused around education. And so, like I said, right now we are running a healthcare provider study. We just wrapped up two other research studies earlier this year, COVID-19 and environmental sustainability and social justice study. And then we, on the education side, we conduct community education events with partners. I have several different academic colleagues and partnerships that we work with. So Boston University is one of them. Also Excelsior College, I sit on their advisory board for their curriculum development. So from the education side, we work with academic partners to help them conduct high quality cannabis education, both at undergraduate master's level. I've also partnered with the community colleges and helped Cannabis Education Center be established at Holyoke Community College. So they run workforce training programs and I'm a part of that as well. But then we run general community education events. So if a partner is interested in getting the word out about cannabis and either destigmatize or in whatever way they want, we work with groups like that. So right now there's a Canna Curious event series that we have. The third one will be in December. The first two events education wise were really about, really trying to break it down for general consumers. What's the history of the industry or what's the state of the research around just for consumers and patients. But like I said, we do education programs that are, geared towards workforce training for the cannabis industry, for example. The exciting social justice program that we launched this month, this past month, since now it's December, is together with Minorities for Medical Marijuana and Massachusetts chapter. And it's an apprenticeship program where we are working to provide paid and mentored learning opportunities at regulated licensed operators in Massachusetts for people negatively impacted by the war on drugs or who live in the 29 cities in Massachusetts that have been identified or are part of the state's equity program. So our first apprentice is on board in our first partner DDM. Right after this, I'm going to get her in our learning management system. And her focus, she's a nurse, and our first apprentice is a nurse, and her apprenticeship appointment is at a retail dispensary in Mass, and she'll be working on a project that will be working to enhance their cannabis consumer education materials. So we'll providing, a lot of the data and resources, and from our end, Minorities for Medical Marijuana is giving them membership and other benefits for participating in the program, and we're excited to kind of grow this program next year.
Awesome.
And other ways that we work with companies are now, we've been doing these sort of research studies that have been working to engage the industry at large. So those studies I spoke about before, we did a lot of fundraising and partnership with recruiting companies to join our study, so to speak. But we're now excited to expand our offerings and services. So if companies are interested in conducting custom studies, research studies, maybe one group is interested in looking at cannabis and cancer, other things. And I mean this here locally in Massachusetts. We're really excited to start to be able to move into that area and some exciting discussions with a few large operators right now about moving forward with some of their research plans. So we'll be continuing our ongoing, work at the healthcare provider study lasts until August of 2022. And we're hopeful to announce, hopefully early next year, some new exciting research program areas, partners.
That's great. Well, thank you guys for the incredible work that you're doing. I know you also recently started a business, 510 Innovations. I'd love to hear a little about that.
Yeah, and thanks for the help and advice about it. So 510 Innovations just launched this company. It's last month. It's an LLC. And this company is actually intending to provide high-level data analytic and visualization services for the cannabis, entheogenic, and psychedelic industries and healthcare innovation at large. So back to what we were talking about earlier, lots of groups and lots of people have lots of data, and there's all this data, but data is only so valuable if you're using it. And what I realized is that there's probably potential room and opportunity to take and triangulate data sources. You know, either one company has some information that they would like to, you know, really understand how that would improve their bottom line or improve their outcomes. And then we have a couple of partnerships in the 510 innovations with other data sets that can be triangulated to help make meaning of data and visualize that. So it's an exciting new company just getting off the ground. We'll be really, really launching in 2023, you know, early next, or yeah, 2022, excuse me. Again, back to that time thing, what year are we? In January. But it's essentially providing data and analytic services.
That's great and exciting, and looking forward to seeing how that evolves and to hopefully helping you out with that along the way. You briefly mentioned some of your art, and you mentioned to me that, you know, most people might not know that you're an artist. Would love to hear a little more about that and specifically about the awareness project you mentioned.
Yeah, thanks for asking. Yeah, I am a long-standing artist. I've been making jewelry. I started off in jewelry, and I've been making jewelry since I was, since I was in high school. And when I lived in Africa, when I lived in Ethiopia, I had a really strong jewelry business. When I traveled, also when I traveled around all those different countries, one of the things that I did in that time was collect beads and really work on making and selling jewelry. But so I haven't really done a lot of art in the last couple of years because I've been so focused on the science side, and I put my jewelry to the wayside, and I've just been, you know, thinking about science. And in the last 6 months or so, I've really tried to explore, you know, spending more time on my art and really kind of practicing that in addition to my science. So I fell into a couple of different art areas. I was started by dabbling in stained glass. So a couple months ago, you know, I'm learning how to do stained glass. This is my workshop. You can see this is my art station right here. So I'm sitting here, stained glass and whatever. And then I fell into leather working, and I was like, okay, and I'm trying to just test these things out to see what I can do and what do I like and to kind of take on in the future. So I started leather working a little bit. And then somehow I fell into resin art. So thinking about how do you put things in resin, I was also very touched by when I worked in HIV, the AIDS quilt. Do you know about the AIDS quilt?
Not much. Would love to hear about it.
Okay, so the AIDS quilt was a way. It was a quilt where people came and they made pieces in honor of losing somebody to HIV. And this quilt became like a really big icon in terms of public awareness around HIV and advocacy. And it was very powerful in my work. And it was an awareness project. And so I took that concept, and as we've been talking, you know, the last couple of months, I've been presenting all of this data about why people are consuming, and we're dealing with these really horrible health emergencies right now with COVID and the opioid epidemic, and here I am doing art, and so I thought, well, maybe we could work on a way that, as I'm presenting all this data, is there a way that I can incorporate my art into this as well? So I decided to start what's called the Phoenix Art Project. And over the last couple of months, I'll pull it out. I went to several different cannabis cups and expos in the last couple of months. and had pieces basically asked people if they wanted to come make a piece of resin art with me in honor of somebody that they've lost due to addiction and the opioid epidemic. And then I would take that art with me when I gave my data talks, you know, to show that these are lives and people, not just numbers on a screen. And so for three different times I, you know, hosted in the last couple of months at, you know, people coming to do the art, and this is what has been created.
Wow.
So if you can really see it, I've fused it all into one.
Cool.
But what I did was have pieces of cannabis and also just different pieces of natural things, plants, crystals, keys, people could use to kind of put together. And then they use this two-part, I'm now using Ecopoxy, which is not plastic, but they use that to kind of memorialize it in a time capsule. And so I've now fused, these are all individual pieces, and now I've put them all together so that I can carry it with me easier. But as a result, I started really getting much more into it. And all of my pieces of art really now try to involve cannabis leaves.
That's beautiful. And for those that are just listening, is there anywhere they can go later to see any of this? Do you post it anywhere?
Yeah, I'm really excited because I launched an Etsy page. And awesome. So they can go to the Phoenix Art Project on Etsy. That's where I have all the art there. I'm not selling the art that I am working on with people. That's a little different project. But whatever art I sell through this goes to fund that. I'm trying to use it as a way to then host another event. And so I can get some funding to get more people to come and do the art together. But excitingly today, the Northeast, do you know the Leaf magazines, Northeast Leaf? And yeah, so I got, I met them when I started the Phoenix Art Project a couple months ago. They came over and they were like, whoa, your art's really cool. And today I got launched the Leaf gift guide for the holiday.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Congratulations. I'm excited that it's going to get out there, and it is beautiful work. I'm excited to take a look at the Etsy page later.
Yeah, thanks. And I've got an Instagram page and a Facebook page going, and
I'll make sure to link it all in the show notes.
Cool, thank you. It's really fun. So like next week I'm going to three events, so I'll be there with pop-up art, with talk about data, and raising awareness all at the same time. So it's a great way for me to combine the love of, you know, creativity and with what I do now. So
yeah, I think that's a great way to work in some of your other passions. I think we both share that, you know, we have a variety of passions, and it's always good to find ways to integrate them and integrate various levels of creativity. You know, you can be a data scientist and also love art.
Totally.
Exactly. That's awesome. So, you know, you mentioned earlier about a teacher that came up to you and, you know, told you about how your work had affected her. Are there any other stories that stick out, in terms of when you really saw how your work could affect change?
Yeah. Well, even, you know, that woman was, you know, pretty powerful from just an individual perspective. You know, the work that we did with the veterans research study has really, I think, hopefully made some kind of dent in advocacy around that. You know, the data has been used. It's in two bills in the state house right now. So it's being used to put into policy practice. That study helped launch Cannabis Patient Care magazine, which is a publication under Cannabis Science and Technology. So the results of the veteran study was part of the first seminal issue of that. Honestly, I really think that the data and the work that I've done has helped a number of, helped tremendously, at least when I was, you know, for many companies, the events that we ran, I think we helped form a number of partnerships, you know, provided opportunities where companies could meet and partner. You know, we now see a cannabis research license category here. I could see a lot of benefits from, you know, the work that we've done, and I hope to continue to see a lot more, and having positive impacts on the industry.
Yeah, I can only see that continuing for you and your team. It's clear the impact that you guys have already had, and seeing the research that you've brought to the space and just the doors that you've opened for people and the connections that you've made, you know, whether that's via your events or otherwise. I've seen firsthand a lot of the impact, and even just going to these BU competitions each year, every year I meet people that you've impacted. So, you know, honored to work with you.
Oh, honored to work with you too. Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, there's real room to continue to think about the medical side. And I'm grateful that you also continue to work on advancing medical. I think it could be so easy to get lost in, sure, adult use and personal use, but we can't leave our patients behind because, you know, there really is a lot of medicinal value to cannabis. So I'm just gonna keep going on that side too. I also agree with personal use or recreational use. Of course, but
likewise. And for me, I think everyone should have access to the plant if they wanted. And, but medical patients that are currently suffering are certainly the most important. And, you know, in somewhere like South Carolina, where I've been doing a lot of work, that is an easier sell in general to someone that is incredibly old school or conservative that, hey, don't you want to have compassion for people? So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. One question that I always find interesting with my guests is there an experience from your childhood that you recall that showed you the importance of giving back, you know, regardless of which side of that giving you were on?
I guess I was exposed to my parents are very, very giving people and very caring people. And so I was exposed to that very early on to really want to care about changing things in a positive way and want to volunteer and want to help. And I started, you know, when I was very young, trying to just always like help, fix, and do. So I think, you know, just being raised by very thoughtful people around wanting to be, you know, give back. I think would probably be the most quintessential part of my childhood. But when I was in Zimbabwe and that story was really just so eye-opening for me because I had come, you know, coming from America, we have we have so much. You go into a grocery store and you can pick out, you know, 100 different kinds of breakfast cereal, but knowing what it's like in very impoverished situations, which is nothing at all like that, it's an important thing it's been a really impactful thing in my life. I now can't take what I have for granted. I know how people live in poverty, and I've seen them die in poverty, and I've tried to help them not die. So it'll be hard to take compassion out of my heart. But yeah, I think, you know, I guess being exposed at such an early age to that high level of poverty.
Yeah, I mean, I can only imagine how impactful that would be. And maybe I didn't ask enough earlier, and we were talking about Africa. What was it like to be there and live there as a part of your everyday life? You know, I certainly met plenty of Americans that have gone and visited and, you know, done mission trips and things like that. But what was it like to live there every day?
Yeah, I mean, to be quite frank, I was privileged, you know, to live there. Like it was because I had a job, you know, and so I have to recognize also that I lived in very good housing conditions. And but it was.
And just to remind us, you were mostly living in Ethiopia in your time there? Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I lived mainly in Ethiopia, and the other times I would just travel in and out of countries for short-term TA. So in Ethiopia, you know, it was, oh, wow. It's like one of my favorite countries in the world, if that makes sense. The people... watching a culture and just, I learned the language. I just really tried to understand such a historical country, but one of the poorest. And, you know, just the way that the culture is, the way that the language is very different and respectful. And like there's a whole tense for how you talk to people with respect, like a tone. So like she, he, but respect toned. It's very interesting. It feels like a whole other life. It was a whole other life as well. But it was fascinating. I mean, it was difficult, but, you know, I did always feel like I learned the language and I really tried my best to do a really good job. But I also learned that I'm never, you know, I am an American, I'm a white woman, that's what I am. And can't change that, but it doesn't mean that I don't have, core values of social justice and change because of my skin color. But I was very aware of my skin color. And obviously when you're one of two people that are white in an office of 175, so that was really, I was also at the time married to an Ethiopian. And so having an interracial relationship and watching that and how people treated and all sorts, you know, it's very, very fascinating stuff. It was interesting. It was, like I said, you know, it was from a work perspective, I'm proud of the work that we did and, very different life.
Yeah, I'm sure. So you talked about your parents and how impactful they were, you know, is there anyone that you've considered a mentor over your career?
Yeah, several people have been very influential. You have been a very influential mentor and currently. One of the people that I met early on in Ethiopia, he's now the head of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Adhanom. And, you know, he was at the time when I met him, he was a mayor. And he then grew to, you know, now be the head of the World Health Organization. And a lot of the ways that he had approached health, I really admired in Ethiopia, the way that he implemented some of these programs. My father has been a mentor. BU's been a mentor. In the cannabis industry, one of the biggest research mentors of mine is Dr. Stacey Gruber and Dr. Peter Grunspoon. And they sit on the advisory board for the nonprofit and have Dr. Gruber I've worked with for 4 years now. And I really admire her and we still work together, and I'm excited about future work that we've got going on and in the works and planning. And Dr. Peter Grinspoon is an amazing clinician, if nobody knows who he is, but his father was Dr. Lester Grinspoon, who was not given professorship at Harvard because of his work in cannabis and reform in the academic sector. Peter, his son, works at Mass General, and he's a clinician and a colleague of mine and works on the cannabis side too. So I look to him, I call him often. I'm excited. We're running a cannabis science fair at the Build Lab next week. And Dr. Grinspoon will be giving a keynote talk and talking about his role and his work. So if folks, we won't have that event live streamed, but if folks around the Boston area pop by and hear us.
Well, this may end up getting published after your event. So if that's the case, hopefully it will have gone very well and people will be able to attend future events.
Awesome. Yeah, we're hoping for it to be an annual event. So.
So we've talked a lot about your work thus far and what you've been up to in the Massachusetts community and how you've been expanding cannabis research. Is there anywhere that you sort of see yourself going or where you hope all of this is going to lead down the road?
Yeah, I'm excited. Yesterday, I announced that I've been invited to be an advisory board member of Cannabis BPO. They're a contact call center and other solution provider for the cannabis industry. I'm excited to, be on their board and start to work with them in different capacities as well. Where I see myself is I'd like to continue to conduct really high quality cannabis research studies together with partners and really continue to bridge this gap between the industry and where our healthcare industry is right now. I think that's a new focus. I mean, right now I'm running a healthcare provider study. I've extensive work in developing continuing medical education programs and training programs in HIV, et cetera. So, and I've been working on educational programs. So looking more towards the healthcare side, I'm interested in, and, conducting rigorous trials. I'm really hopeful to get a research license and be able to operate with companies doing clinical trials and human populations and everything that I've been hoping that the state would be able to, that they've taken and listened. So I see myself in the next 5 years, trying to continue to collaborate with some of the leading researchers in the field here and with the industry and continue to make a difference, conducting all sorts of different types of research studies. And then through 510 Innovations, really excited to see where the intersection between cannabis and entheogenic medicine and our current healthcare system, how that interacts and how that intersects and how we can come up with transformative new treatment paradigms and ways that we can address some of the main health issues that we face. And COVID, anxiety, and PTSD, and with the opioid crisis. So yeah, I'm hopeful that, some of the work in the next 5 years can really make a positive impact on people not dying as much as they are. And how can we find different lethal, non-lethal alternatives to introduce, and how do we do that safely, effectively, and responsibly? So,
well, I look forward to witnessing the progress as you continue. And, one thing, we talked a little bit about it directly before the recording, but people have liked the idea of my guests asking me a question. And so you feel free.
Yeah, good. I have so many questions for you, but my first one is, well, what drew you to cannabis? And what was the real inspiration behind creating the VU competition that we ended up winning the first year?
Yeah, I'll go into the first part briefly in terms of what drew me to cannabis. Growing up in South Carolina, cannabis and most substances were demonized. And, growing up, I was told that it was just something that you weren't supposed to do. It was bad. And so, I didn't try it for a long time. I didn't try it until my early 20s. And when I did, I was like, why has everyone been saying that this is so awful for so long? Like, it doesn't seem that way. And that drove me to do a lot of research into it and just started to dig in. I wanted to learn. I wanted to get an understanding of the history of the plant and how it became demonized. And, I quickly learned about all of the use cases it's had over thousands of years. And at the same time, I was seeing Colorado start to legalize and other places as well. And as a business person, I saw an opportunity, like here's a product that I was beginning to not only enjoy, but it was adding value to my life in terms of helping with things like anxiety. And I thought, well, how many times in my life am I going to get an opportunity to get involved in an industry that already has buyers all over the world? So, his financial interest kind of drew me in. But then I started to meet as many people as I could in the space, attend as many events as I could. And I quickly learned about the incredible atrocities of the war on drugs and the inequality in terms of enforcement. And, I was outraged by it. I was disgusted by the fact that there's people that need cannabis medicine that can't get it and are given horrible alternatives with lots of side effects. And so really it started off, my business sense drew me to the space, but my compassion is what's really driven me and driven my passion for it and for some of the work that I do. And when it comes to BU and the competition, after college, within a couple of years, I had started working with the Startup Accelerator at BU, now known as the Build Lab. And I saw this as an opportunity to get BU involved in this space and show that cannabis truly is a career opportunity for its students. And so when cannabis was legalized, the vote went through in Massachusetts, that's really when I started the conversation. I'd kind of been having the conversation lightly with my buddy Dave Frew and the alumni, with the Questrom alumni office at BU. And he and I had lunch one day with Ian Mashter, you know, and I kind of posed this concept of a startup competition as a way to make BU a leader in cannabis, to show other schools that, hey, this is a real thing. This is something we should not only acknowledge, but support. And I really, really appreciate their willingness and openness to supporting that concept. You know, they had to take that all the way up the flagpole at BU. And we were really fortunate that everyone along the way kind of got where we were coming from and could see that this was something that was important. And to have done 5 years of our competition has been, you know, a dream come true. And when Mike and I first started this, we were hopeful that it would become something annual. And after year one, you know, we're like, wow, that was amazing. You were there, you know, we could feel the energy in the air. This was starting conversations within the academic community, within BU, and people were just excited to see a sign up at campus that, like, what, there's a cannabis event on campus? And, you know, we weren't saying, hey, go smoke up in your dorm room, because which BU doesn't allow. You know, we're saying, hey, this is a real career opportunity, and there's a lot of research to be done. There's a lot of people that can be helped. So it was just something that came together out of our passions in a way that we felt we could showcase what cannabis is and what it offers. And also something we could bring back to BU for, you know, the great experiences that we had there. And it honestly is one of the most fun things we work on every year. And seeing the excitement and the innovation that comes from startups in the space, especially from often from students and alumni, it's been really incredible. And we've seen other colleges come on board. Some of them have actually talked to us to try to get some advice on it, and that's been tremendous. Yeah, we worked with Ohio State a little bit on a cannabis sprint that they did. And I think if Mike and I had the time, we would love to do this at a bunch of schools and turn it into some kind of tournament or something. But unfortunately, we have too much time on the things that pay the bills. So,
yeah, well, it's made a tremendous impact here. And, you know, kudos to y'all for doing it, because I wouldn't be here without that competition. You know, that was a crucial part of my journey. So kudos to y'all. And you definitely have been. It's exciting. You were the first. So it's exciting to hear that other colleges are coming on now too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been awesome. And, like I said, we'd love to be running them at a bunch of places, but even if anyone listening is involved in, colleges and startups there and, anything of that nature, we're always happy to help share templates, things like that, because we just want this to happen. We want to keep this going and to also show, you know, the colleges and the students what they can do in cannabis.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. We support.
Of course. Yeah. Thank you for the question. So I get to glow about the competition that we love doing. And, you know, next up on my list, I was going to ask you this question I've been asking all my guests. I've gotten some really interesting answers. If you could snap your fingers and fix one thing in the world, what would it be? And how do you think that change would reverberate?
If I could snap my fingers and fix one thing in the world, it would be the opiate crisis right now in the United States, honestly. And it's really, really out of control here. And I've been hearing, you know, more and more as of late, COVID and all of these restrictions are making our epidemic so much worse here. So when I've been going around, I'm when you talk to younger people that are in their 20s and people that are, you know, in their teens, they face some really serious you know, issues right now with this, with the opioid epidemic and crime, and just much different than when I was in my 20s. And so I just feel sad that young people, you know, are faced with really this challenge right now. You know, if I could snap my fingers and fix it, I think the world, you know, how would that reverberate? I think a lot of people would be really happy to not see their moms, sisters, brothers, sons, daughters die from needlessly. Yeah. And from, you know, things that are happening now with fentanyl and stuff like this. So I understand that, you know, there's, this is why I think it's so important that medical cannabis has a non-lethal alternative, because, you know, we need other options out there right now. And there are treatment, you know, methadone and all these other treatment patterns, but I wish our young people didn't have to suffer and die from something yeah. that, you know, has been created in the last couple of decades. And, you know, so yeah. hopefully, you know, we could hopefully the word around cannabis and its role as a non-lethal alternative can have some kind of impact there.
Yeah. Solving that crisis would save so many lives. And like you said, the dent that cannabis can make in it is worth fighting for. And appreciate that you've been doing that. And I'm sure that a lot of listeners are interested in supporting your work. What's the best way that they can do that?
Thanks. Yeah. We always love any kind of donation or support or financial support to keep going. We are a tax deductible organization, if that qualifies for the group. So you can go to our website at cannabiscenterofexcellence.org. And we have a number of ways, either, you know, groups can support our work financially through a donation, like I said, or we can partner on different research studies or design custom educational programs together. So go to our website. It's just been updated. And there's a couple of ways that groups can get involved. And we've got some exciting campaigns launching, like I said, with full force in early next year. So different education campaigns around stuff that we've been talking about, medical cannabis and medication alternatives. So people can, companies, individuals, anybody can sign up and support there. We're also on LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. So you can, you know, follow our postings and see new up and coming, emerging, exciting opportunities as they come along.
Awesome. Well, hopefully you continue to inspire people the way that you have been over these many years, and I'm excited to keep our conversation going. And thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And it's always a pleasure to talk and connect. You're a great mentor of mine, so thank you.
Thank you, Mary, and I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of People Are the Answer. To find out more, go to peoplearetheanswer.com.